This chemistry cassette is the third tape in the A-level series produced by the Educational Techniques Group Trust of the Royal Society of Chemistry. It's entitled Entropy, the Driving Force of Change, and has been prepared and is presented by Graham Hill, who is Deputy Headmaster at Dr. Challoner's Grammar School in Amersham, and John Holman, who is Head of Science at Watford Grammar School. The cassette is accompanied by a workbook, which is an essential part of the study package. It contains diagrams, equations, formulae, and other material which the speakers will frequently refer to. So, have the workbook with you as you listen, and also have pen and paper so that you can make notes. If you look into the workbook, you will see that it's divided into numbered sections that we call frames. The speakers will give you the appropriate frame number when they want you to look at any of the material there. You may also have noticed that some of the frames contain problems. Be ready to attempt these as you work through the tape. The answers are at the end of the book, but don't look at them until you've attempted the problems. A great advantage of an audio tape is that you can work through it at your own rate. Switch off if you want to spend a little time digesting what you have heard, or if you want to make some notes or do a problem. And use the rewind control if you want to go again over something that you've not fully understood on a first hearing. Now here are Graham Hill and John Holman. John speaks first.
Like other programmes in this series, we shall be exploring a major theme that links together several areas of chemistry. In this programme, the theme is entropy, the driving force behind all chemical reactions, and indeed all change. Let's first consider a few observations. If we turn on a gas tap, gas comes out. It spreads out into the atmosphere. But left to itself, the reverse process doesn't occur. To get the gas out of the atmosphere, back into the gas main, would be an extremely difficult process. If we leave a hot cup of tea, it will get cold, without us having to do anything about it. But it won't get hotter on its own. We actually have to do something if we want to heat it up. If we take a new pack of cards, we can easily disarrange it by shuffling it or dropping it on the floor. But to put the cards back into order again is quite a tedious business. Although it seems common sense, why should these three very different sorts of processes all go easily in one direction, but only with difficulty in the other? It looks as though there is a sort of one-way system built into the universe. How does this come about? This one-way system is often evident in chemistry. Some reactions will go very easily in one direction, but not in the other. Magnesium and oxygen react together readily, as you will appreciate if you have ever seen magnesium burning in air. But to get magnesium back from the resulting magnesium oxide is a complicated and expensive process. In contrast, gold and oxygen react only with difficulty, which is one reason why gold is so valuable. Hydrogen and oxygen react explosively if you put a lighted match to a mixture of the two, producing water as the product of the reaction, together with a lot of heat. On the other hand, it is quite difficult to convert water back into hydrogen and oxygen. The usual way is by electrolysis, and you only get the gases so long as you continue to pass a current through the water. Quite a contrast with the explosion. Well, why should processes go easily in one direction, but only with difficulty in the other? And what determines what the preferred direction is? There are different ways of answering these questions. But in this program, we'll be looking for a principle that answers all questions concerned with why things happen. We will be looking for the driving force in chemical changes, and we shall find that all change is governed by the rules of probability and chance.
Let's begin by looking at the behaviour of gases. Look at frame 1 in the workbook. Here we have an imaginary situation with just 10 molecules in one gas jar, and none at all in the other. In normal situations, of course, the numbers of molecules in a normal-sized gas jar would be vastly larger. But we can simplify the situation by considering just 10. What will happen when the cover separating the two jars is removed? Your instinct will tell you that the gas will spread out to fill both jars. But why? Well, it happens purely by chance. The molecules don't care where they go, and they move around completely at random. Once the cover is removed, it's likely that some of them will move into the right-hand jar, as illustrated in frame 2. So what is the likelihood that at a given instant of time, we would find the molecules all in the left-hand jar, or all in the right-hand jar for that matter? Well, we can quite easily count the number of ways the molecules could distribute themselves between the two jars. For each molecule, there are two places it could be: in the left-hand jar or in the right-hand jar. For each of the 10 molecules, we could describe its position as L for left or R for right. Frame 3 shows some of the possible arrangements. Altogether, there are 2 to the power 10 such arrangements, because there are 2 possible positions for each of the 10 molecules. Now, 2 to the power 10 is 1024. So we can say that there are 1024 different ways the molecules can be distributed between the two jars. But only one of these arrangements has all the molecules in the left-hand jar, and only one has all the molecules in the right-hand jar. In other words, there is only one chance in about 1,000 that all the molecules will be found in the left-hand jar. This is what we expect from instinct, and now we know why it happens, because of the laws of chance. Suppose we only had 6 molecules in the left-hand jar at the start. What's the chance that at a given instant, after removing the cover, we would find all of them in the left-hand jar, instead of being distributed between both jars?
Let's now consider the situation where we have realistic numbers of molecules, say 10 to the 22. This is about the number we would have in an average gas jar. In this case, the number of ways the molecules can arrange themselves between the jars is 2 to the power of 10 to the 22, as shown in frame 4. 2 to the power of 10 to the 22 is an unbelievably large number, and only one of these arrangements has all the molecules in the jar where they started. It's no longer just probable that we would find the molecules spread out, it's certain, because the numbers are so huge. The probability of ever finding all the molecules in one jar would be infinitesimally small. This number of arrangements, W, is a very important quantity, because the bigger the value of W is for a particular event, the more likely that event is to happen. Unfortunately, W turns out in many cases to be an enormous quantity, like 2 to the power of 10 to the 22, which is not very easy either to write or to think about. So we need to scale it down in some way. This is done first by taking the natural logarithm of W, and then by multiplying it by a scaling constant, as shown in frame 5. The value chosen for the scaling constant is 1.38 times 10 to the minus 23 joules per Kelvin. That might seem a rather arbitrary figure, but there are some good reasons behind the choice, though we don't have time to go into them in this short program. The constant is given the symbol K and is called the Boltzmann constant. The quantity K natural log W is given a special name and symbol. The name is entropy, and the symbol is S. Use the formula on frame 5 to calculate the entropy change when 10 to the 22 molecules, originally in the left-hand jar, are allowed to occupy both jars.
Entropy is a very useful concept and has important applications in many branches of science and engineering. We have already seen that the bigger we make W, and the more ways there are for something to happen, the more likely it is to happen. Since, as we have seen, entropy is directly related to natural log W, the bigger the value of W, the bigger the entropy. In other words, events that are likely to happen lead to larger entropies. Whenever an event happens spontaneously, of its own accord, entropy always increases. Another way of putting this is to say that the entropy change delta S is always positive. The effects of entropy are all around us. If you want to dry some washing, the best plan is to put it on a clothesline, as in frame 6. By doing this, you increase the number of ways W in which the water can vaporize off the washing line into the air. If you leave the washing in a plastic bag, W is much smaller, and the water is more likely to stay on the washing. We can also think of pollution problems in terms of entropy. As frame 7 shows, if a pollutant is released through a factory chimney, it is much more likely to be found spread around the countryside than in the factory. There are far more ways the pollutant molecules can be spread throughout the air than be safely locked up inside the factory. It looks as though the same laws of chance apply.
Yes, Graham, but we need to be a bit careful with this idea. As you know, a lot of radioactive and heavy metal waste has been discharged into the sea because it's considered that it would be much less harmful if it's widely distributed than if it's kept all in one place. But some fish have the ability to concentrate radioactive elements and heavy metals in their bodies, and this can create a hazard to people eating the fish. That seems to be working contrary to the argument that you've just been putting forward.
True, but as we shall see later, that doesn't invalidate what we've been saying. It just means that situations are more complex than the ones that we have considered so far. Those fish really are just doing what you do when you sort a pack of shuffled cards. Anyway, for the present, let's stick to the simple cases.
Well, let's get back to entropy, symbol S, which we defined as equal to K natural log W. The cases that we have dealt with so far have concerned the distribution of molecules in space. But as we've noted in frame 8, entropy is also dependent on the distribution of energy among molecules, and we need to consider the number of different ways this can be done. Before going on to this, you might like to switch off the tape and tackle the two problems we've already raised in frames 3 and 5. You're probably familiar with the idea that energy comes in small amounts or packets, called quanta. When we have a group of molecules, they all share the energy they possess. So, just as we did for molecules, we can count the number of ways W of arranging the energy quanta. Frame 9 shows a simple example. Two molecules share four quanta among themselves. The table in frame 9 shows the different ways in which these four quanta can be shared. In this particular case, there are five ways, so W is 5. Try working out the value of W when two molecules share 10 quanta. Try it also for three molecules sharing 10 quanta. You can see that the number of ways of sharing quanta gets bigger the more quanta there are, and the more molecules they are shared between. For realistic numbers of molecules and realistic numbers of quanta, say around 10 to the 23 of each, the values of W become enormous. Once again, we can use the formula S equals K natural log W to scale down W and convert it to entropy. Now, just as molecules tend to distribute themselves in the available space, so do energy quanta tend to spread themselves around the available molecules. This, in fact, is why hot things always cool. Frame 10 illustrates this for a cup of tea, but the same ideas apply to all hot objects. They always cool to the temperature of their surroundings, because this is vastly more probable than anything else. This results in an increase in W, and so an increase in entropy. The tendency of energy quanta to spread themselves around is a constant problem when we're trying to conserve heat, as we can see from the continual encouragement that needs to be given to people to insulate their houses. If we want to keep that cup of tea hot, the most effective way is to use a thermos flask. Other forms of energy can, however, be less troublesome than heat. For example, chemical energy can quite easily be kept locked up. Fossil fuels like coal and oil have maintained their stored chemical energy, originally derived from the sun, for millions of years. But as soon as we burn that fuel and convert the chemical energy into heat, we have the problem that heat can be easily wasted. Clearly, heat has a greater tendency to distribute itself than other forms of energy. Energy conservation is essentially a matter of restraining this tendency.
Well, so far we've been talking at a rather abstract and theoretical level, and the calculations that we've done have not really been very practical ones. However, entropy is a quantity which can be measured and which is tabulated in data books, in the same way as other quantities like atomic mass, density, enthalpy changes, and so on. Though we can't, on this tape, go into the experimental methods that are used to measure entropies. Frame 11 gives the standard measured entropies at 298 Kelvin of a number of substances. Standard entropies are entropies that are measured under a specified reference condition. Generally, for entropies, we can take this condition as being a pressure of one atmosphere. We also need to be clear about the temperature to which the standard entropies refer. In this program, the standard entropies we use will refer to 298 Kelvin, like those in frame 11. If you study the table carefully, you'll notice a number of important points. First, solids generally have lower standard entropies than liquids, and liquids are lower than gases. This isn't really surprising when you think how many more ways there are of distributing molecules and energy quanta among free, randomly moving molecules of gas compared to molecules in liquids and solids where their motion is restricted. Second, we find that larger, more complex molecules like propane have higher standard entropies than simpler ones like methane. This is because there are more ways of arranging the energy within a molecule as that molecule becomes more complex. With these ideas in mind, try to explain why diamond has a lower standard entropy than practically any other solid, including graphite. Try also to explain why carbon dioxide has a higher standard entropy than oxygen. It's very useful for chemists to know the entropy change in a reaction. This is easy to find in a qualitative way using a simple rule. In general, a reaction will have a positive entropy change if the product molecules have less restrictions on them than the reactant molecules. The least restricted molecules are those in the gas phase, so if the number of moles of gas increases in a reaction, then we can reckon the entropy will increase. Try some of the examples in frame 12. In which reactions will the entropy of the chemicals increase? Once we know the standard entropies of substances, it's also quite easy to get a quantitative value for the standard entropy change occurring during a reaction. Frame 13 gives an example. The calculation is just a matter of adding up the standard entropies of the products and then subtracting the standard entropy values for the reactants to get the standard entropy change. This is very much like a Hess cycle calculation involving enthalpy changes or a Born-Haber cycle. For the example in frame 13, we simply take the standard entropy of the products, which is 213.6 joules per Kelvin per mole, and subtract the standard entropy of the reactants, 2.4 joules per Kelvin per mole for the diamond and 205 joules per Kelvin per mole for the oxygen. This gives an overall standard entropy change of plus 6.2 joules per Kelvin per mole. But remember that this entropy change is only for this reaction under standard conditions at 298 Kelvin. It tells us nothing about other entropy changes that may happen elsewhere or under other conditions. In this particular reaction, we know that heat is released, which may warm up the surroundings. As we shall see shortly, this can make a big difference to the total entropy change. Before moving on, see if you can calculate the standard entropy change in the chemicals when one mole of methane burns to give carbon dioxide and water. You will need to use the data from the table in frame 11. This might be a convenient point to switch off the tape and attempt some of the other questions as well.
So far, we've been looking at entropy changes that accompany chemical reactions, and it seems that whenever a reaction takes place, the entropy cannot decrease. But consider a simple example, the freezing of water. Frame 15 shows the figures for this process. You can see that the standard entropy of ice is lower than that of water, so delta S standard is negative, and entropy has decreased. Why, then, does water ever freeze? Well, the answer lies in the other piece of data given in frame 15, delta H standard. This shows that when a mole of water freezes, 6,000 joules of energy are given out. This energy gets passed to the surroundings, the air, the container, or whatever happens to be nearby. And of course, passing energy quanta to these surroundings must increase their entropy, because as soon as they receive more quanta, they have a greater number of ways of distributing them. Frame 16 explains the idea. Frame 16 also suggests why it is possible to have physical and chemical processes in which the entropy change appears to be negative. Provided there is a bigger positive entropy change in the surroundings, we can afford a negative entropy change in the system itself. In this way, the overall entropy change is positive. Incidentally, that word system is often used to refer to the reacting chemicals when we want to distinguish them from the surroundings. But how can we calculate the entropy change in the surroundings? We shall need to do this in order to work out the overall entropy change for the system plus the surroundings. Fortunately, there's a very simple way to do it, provided we're working at constant pressure. As you can see from frame 17, the entropy change in the surroundings is simply minus delta H over T, the negative of the enthalpy change divided by the temperature at which that change takes place. If you think about it, this equation makes sense. In an exothermic reaction, a quantity of heat equal to minus delta H is passed to the surroundings. As minus delta H gets bigger, more energy quanta is passed to the surroundings, so there's a larger increase in entropy. This is why we have the minus delta H term on the top of the expression. But if the surroundings are already hot, the energy passed to them will make less difference than if they're cold. So that's why we divide by T.
You know, it's rather like passing money around instead of heat. If you have £10 in the bank and you pay in another £10, your bank account will be doubled. On the other hand, if you have £1,000, paying in another £10 will increase your bank balance by only 0.1%. The smaller your original balance, the greater the effect of adding to it.
That's right. Of course, we haven't actually proved the equation delta S surroundings equals minus delta H over T. We've just established that it seems reasonable. To derive it, we would have to go deeper into the subject of thermodynamics. But if we did, that particular equation is what we would get.
Let's apply this useful equation to the freezing of water. We can use it to find the standard entropy change in the surroundings when water freezes. Frame 18 shows the calculations. The important thing to remember is that we must take into account both the water itself, which we call the system, and its surroundings. So we work out the total entropy change by adding together the entropy changes in the system and the surroundings. On a warm summer's day, the temperature might be 27 degrees Celsius, which is 300 Kelvin. At this temperature, the standard entropy change in the surroundings will be plus 20 joules per Kelvin per mole. Adding this to the standard entropy change in the system gives a total standard entropy change of minus 2 joules per Kelvin per mole. The negative value tells us the water cannot freeze. Frame 19 shows what would happen if the water were inside a freezer. Here the temperature might be minus 23 degrees Celsius, which is 250 Kelvin. The standard entropy change in the surroundings will now be bigger, because the temperature is lower. It comes to plus 24 joules per Kelvin per mole. Adding this value to the standard entropy change in the system gives a total entropy change of plus 2 joules per Kelvin per mole. This positive entropy change means that the water will now freeze.
Of course, we've got to be a bit careful here, Graham. The calculations you've just done assume that the delta S standard and delta H standard values for the freezing of water don't change with temperature, but in fact they do change a little.
True. We've used some simplifications and approximations in these calculations, but these are small and the conclusions are still valid. And this simple example is a useful illustration of the way we can calculate total entropy changes. As long as we always remember to consider both the reaction system and the surroundings, we find that the total entropy change is always positive for changes that happen spontaneously. At room temperature, the entropy change in the surroundings for most reactions is usually larger than the entropy change in the system. This is why exothermic reactions are much more common than endothermic ones, because only exothermic reactions give a positive entropy change in the surroundings. Endothermic reactions can happen, but only if the entropy change in the system is large and positive enough to make up for the negative entropy change in the surroundings. Frame 20 shows an example of an endothermic reaction. You may have noticed that the fizzy powder called sherbet feels cool when you eat it. Sherbet is a mixture of sodium hydrogen carbonate and citric acid, and the equation in frame 20 gives the reaction which occurs when these two substances react together. Try to use the principles that we have developed so far to explain why this reaction has a large positive entropy change, big enough to compensate for its being endothermic. The reaction of citric acid with sodium hydrogen carbonate is interesting, but it's a bit of an oddity because endothermic reactions are quite rare. Exothermic reactions are far more common, well, at room temperature anyway. As you raise the temperature, though, things begin to change. Look again at frame 17, and the equation delta S surroundings equals minus delta H over T. As the temperature rises, T becomes larger, and so delta S surroundings becomes smaller. So, at higher temperatures, endothermic reactions are more likely to happen, because at these higher temperatures, delta S surroundings is less negative. On the Sun, where temperatures are enormously high, all sorts of endothermic reactions occur, which could never happen at the low temperatures on Earth. Frame 21 shows one of these processes. On the Sun, water wouldn't just boil, it would split up into hydrogen and oxygen atoms. It's true, there would be a negative entropy change in the surroundings when these endothermic changes occurred, but at the high temperature of the Sun, this negative entropy change would be small, and more than made up for by the positive entropy change you would get when one H2O molecule split up into three atoms. In problem 6, you should have calculated the standard entropy change that would take place in the system when one mole of methane burns. I won't tell you the answer, in case you haven't done the calculation yet, but I can tell you that the answer is negative. If this were the only entropy change involved, methane would never burn, because total entropy changes which are negative are not possible. But you know perfectly well that methane does burn, and many people in Britain depend on this fact to keep themselves warm in winter. And it's the heat given out by burning methane that makes the difference, because it causes a positive entropy change in the surroundings. This positive entropy change is big enough to overcome the negative entropy change in the system, giving an overall total entropy change that is positive. Now, two more problems for you. First, use the information in frame 22 to calculate the standard entropy change in the surroundings when one mole of methane burns. Assume the surroundings are at 298 Kelvin. Use this answer together with your answer to problem 6 to find the total standard entropy change on burning one mole of methane. Second, to give you more practice at finding total entropy changes, use the information in frame 23 to calculate the total standard entropy change at 298 Kelvin when one mole of ammonia is formed from nitrogen and hydrogen.
Now all this may be very neat, but it's a bit of a nuisance having to be in two places at once, having to think about the entropy changes in the system and the surroundings at the same time. To get over this problem, chemists often use a quantity called free energy, which neatly combines together the two entropy changes for any reaction. Look at frame 24. We know that the total entropy change, delta S total, is equal to delta S surroundings plus delta S system. But we also know that delta S surroundings is given by minus delta H over T. So substituting this in the first equation and multiplying by minus T, we get the expression minus T times delta S total equals delta H minus T delta S system. The expression T times delta S total is usually written as delta G, as in the last equation. Delta G is called the Gibbs free energy, but it's really a disguised form of the total entropy change. For any spontaneous reaction, delta S total must be positive. But remember, we said delta G is equal to minus T times delta S total. So whenever delta S total is positive, delta G is negative. This means that for any spontaneous reaction, delta G will always be negative. Values of delta G standard are listed in many data books, just like delta H standard values. Frame 25 gives a few examples. Delta G values can be added and subtracted in the same way as delta H values, using energy cycles. But unlike delta H, delta G takes all the entropy changes in a chemical reaction into account and combines them in a single function. So for any spontaneous reaction, we always find delta G is negative. After the program's finished, use the data in frame 25 to find the standard free energy change which occurs when 1 mole of methane burns. Remember, you can use free energy changes in exactly the same way as enthalpy changes. When you've worked out your answer, compare it with the answer you got for the total standard entropy change in this reaction, in problem 8. You can use this total standard entropy change to get a second value of delta G standard. How do the two values compare?
Chemists find that free energy changes are a very useful way of deciding whether reactions will go. For example, metallurgists find free energy changes helpful when they are deciding how to extract metals from their ores. Most metal ores are oxides, and extracting the metal involves reducing the oxide. The most common reducing agent is carbon, and you will know how carbon is used to extract iron in a blast furnace. Frame 26 shows a blast furnace of the type which is used in the reduction of iron ore. But carbon can't be used in all cases. Whether it will reduce the ore depends on the metal involved and the temperature. In order to find the right conditions for reduction, chemists use what are known as Ellingham diagrams. Ellingham diagrams are graphs of standard free energy change against temperature. Frame 27 shows an Ellingham diagram for three important reactions which may occur when carbon is used to reduce metal oxides. First, look at the line for C plus O2 gives CO2. This is a straight horizontal line, which means delta G standard for this reaction does not change with temperature. At least, not over the temperature range on this graph. On the other hand, the line for 2C plus O2 gives 2CO has a negative gradient. In other words, delta G standard gets more negative as the temperature increases. Why the difference? Well, it's to do with the different entropy changes in the two reactions. Remember that delta G standard is defined as delta H standard minus T delta S standard. Provided delta H standard and delta S standard stay constant as the temperature changes, this is just the equation of a straight line, and the gradient of the graph is minus delta S standard. Now, for the reaction C solid plus O2 gaseous gives CO2 gaseous, the standard entropy change, delta S standard, is approximately zero. This is because there is 1 mole of gas on each side of the equation. The standard entropy of the solid carbon is very small, so we can ignore it. What matters is that a mole of gas reacts to form another mole of gas, so the standard entropies on each side of the equation are approximately equal. which makes delta S standard approximately zero. Since delta S standard is zero, the gradient of the graph is zero. It's a horizontal line. But for the reaction 2C solid plus O2 gaseous gives 2CO gaseous, the situation is rather different. We now have 2 moles of gas on the right-hand side and only one on the left, so the entropy increases during the reaction. Delta S standard is positive. Since the gradient of the graph is minus delta S standard, we have a straight line with a negative gradient. Frame 28 shows a more detailed Ellingham diagram, which includes lines representing the formation of metal oxides. When a metal oxide is reduced, we will, of course, want to drive the reaction in the opposite direction to that shown in these equations. Try to explain why the line for zinc-zinc oxide slopes upwards. Also, try to explain why the gradient of the zinc-zinc oxide line changes at about 900 degrees Celsius.
So how can we use Ellingham diagrams? We know that if we want a chemical reaction to occur, we have to make sure the total entropy change is positive. This is the same as saying that the free energy change for the reaction, delta G, must be negative. And we can use Ellingham diagrams to find the conditions when delta G is negative. Let's use zinc as an example and ask the question, will carbon reduce zinc oxide to zinc? Frame 29 shows a simplified Ellingham diagram which we can use. Notice that on this diagram, the line for zinc oxide is drawn boldly. You can also see that two of the lines for the carbon system have been drawn in bold. These bold lines show the reactions that will be the most effective reducers at a particular temperature. Pretty clearly, the answer to the question, will carbon reduce zinc oxide to zinc, is going to depend on the temperature. Let's try it first at 500 degrees Celsius. The dotted line on frame 29 will help us read off the delta G standard values at that temperature. The calculations are shown in frame 30. For the reduction of zinc oxide to zinc, delta G standard comes to plus 590 kilojoules per mole. Notice that we have to change the sign because we want the reaction to go in the opposite direction to the one shown in the Ellingham diagram. In the same way, we can read off the value of delta G standard for the oxidation of carbon to carbon dioxide. It's minus 380 kilojoules per mole. Adding this to the figure for the reduction of zinc, we get an overall value for delta G standard of plus 210 kilojoules per mole. This positive value tells us carbon will not reduce zinc oxide at 500 degrees Celsius. But at 1200 degrees Celsius, things are rather different, as you can see from frame 31. The overall delta G standard value is now minus 80 kilojoules per mole, a negative value, so carbon will reduce zinc oxide at this higher temperature. Look back at frame 29 and you will see the reason for this difference. At 500 degrees Celsius, the zinc-zinc oxide line is below the carbon-carbon dioxide line, which means the overall delta G standard value is positive, and reduction will not occur. But by the time we reach 1200 degrees Celsius, the lines have crossed over, and the zinc-zinc oxide line is above the carbon-carbon monoxide line. The overall delta G standard is now negative, so reduction can occur. After the program is finished, use frame 29 to find the temperature at which carbon will just reduce zinc oxide. Then use frame 28 to explain why aluminium has to be extracted by electrolysis rather than by reduction with carbon.
In this program, we have looked at entropy, the driving force of change, and we've seen that all change is governed by the laws of chance alone. Because entropy is a measure of chance, changes only occur if they involve an overall increase in entropy. But one last word of warning. Values of delta S total and delta G may suggest that a reaction will be spontaneous, but in reality it may go so slowly that it never happens at all. Delta S and delta G tell us all about the energetic or thermodynamic possibility of a chemical reaction, but they tell us nothing about its kinetic feasibility. That is, how fast it will go. For example, entropy values suggest that the reaction between petrol and oxygen should be spontaneous at room temperature. Yet millions of motorists rely on the fact that this reaction is so slow at room temperature that effectively it doesn't happen at all. Raise the temperature by several hundred degrees Celsius and entropy values tell us the reaction is still spontaneous. And now it can go fast. In fact, at this temperature, it's fast enough to be explosive.